On this episode of Still Loading, Atari, Jolico, and beyond. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Koval, and today on the show, I have a very special guest for you all. For those who have listened to the show for a while, you know I really enjoy video game history, and I've always been fascinated about learning how the industry got started and a lot and its roots. And with me today is someone who actively worked on that, who worked in the game industry in its nascent stages. And he is with me here today to talk about his career and what he's been up to. I have Howie Rubin here. Howie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very, very well and delighted to be here.
Thank you so much for coming on. Like I told you off mic, I really was looking forward to this all week because I like Atari is an era. Atari and like early 80s is an era of history that like I'm really interested in because it was just so different after Nintendo came in. So I'm really excited to learn more about you and learn more about your work in the industry. But to start it off, I did some digging around online trying to find like information about the different companies you worked at. And what I was able to find is that you started in Atari in 1974, but you worked in the arcade business prior to that. How did you get into the arcade business and who did you work for?
Okay. Well, I got into the arcade business and really the game business quite by accident. Way back when in 1967, 1968, I came back from Florida where I was living with a couple of my friends, and I wanted to do, of all things, publish a teenage newspaper that I had started to outline while we were in Florida. So I came back to New Jersey. I was born and bred in New Jersey. And I needed a job. I met a guy by the name of Myron Sugarman through my brother. And Myron was in the coin-operated games business. He would use coin-operated jukebox, pool tables, video games. Well, there were no video games at the time. Slot machines, et cetera, recondition them and send them over to Europe and Asia. He actually hired me that summer to take a little game called a booze barometer, which was a little wire and a contact on a box that sat on a counter. It was a $29 thing that worked on batteries, and I would place them in bars and taverns in Newark, New Jersey. Walk in after 3 or 4 days, there were $15 to $20 worth of nickels in the machine, and I would look at the owner, the bartender, and say, geez, I'm a college kid. I bought a couple of these. I've got to go back to school. Can you buy it from me for $79.50 or $82.30 or whatever it was?
Yeah.
And that's how I actually got into the business. But Myron used to send me to distributorships, and the distributorships distributed every kind of coin-operated equipment from vending to music and games. And I would go in and look at the old equipment and call Myron on the phone. They've got three jukeboxes. This is the model number. They got two pool tables, pinball machines, mm-hmm. et cetera. And we would buy them from them. And then he would recondition them and send them over to Europe and or Asia. One of the companies that I called on was a company in New Jersey. They were the second largest distributor at that time of coin-operated equipment in the metropolitan area. And they approached me. I had met my wife, and it was about time, I guess, to get serious. and they approached me, and they offered me a job selling for the distributorship.
Okay.
So I sold vending equipment. I sold music. I sold pinball machines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's how I actually got into the business. So I worked on the distributorship for about 4 years. And then Betson also had their own routes where they would put the equipment out on location. So they would put vending equipment in industrial sites, and they would put jukeboxes and pool tables and cigarette machines in the bars and taverns in New Jersey. I took over the routes. So I left distribution. I took over the routes, and I met the guys from Atari back in the early 70s because we were distributing and operating their first games.
Okay, and those would have been like Pong, I'm assuming.
The space game, and then, then it moved on to other things. So you moved on to the Space Invaders and the Breakouts and those kind of games. We would put them, because we were pretty large and pretty good distributor, they would send us some of their games for test.
Okay.
So we would put them out for test and give them reports and, see how they did, so that it could determine how many they wanted to build. And I got to know the Atari guys very, very well from that. And they called me one day and they said, we want to open up Atari East Coast, where somebody would have their own building, their own service department, their own this, that, and the other thing. And would you like to be that person? They flew me out to the West Coast. I saw Atari. I saw what was going on. And this was pre-home games.
Okay, so this was just when they're starting out.
It was all coin-op, yeah.
Yeah.
Atari started out in the coin-operated business and then moved into the home business. And I'll tell you how that happened. But so I said, hell yeah. I went out there. I met the people. I saw what they were doing. And it was just impressive. So I accepted the job, and I worked for them for 4 years in the coin-operated business. And then as we were doing that, the consumer business started. So I was there when the consumer business started, and the coin operated guys actually designed and did all the initial work on the consumer products.
Really?
And then they hired a whole new group of people. So there was always a little bit of animosity going on. Hey, we started this crap, and
now they're bringing other ringers in to kind of take over what you guys started.
Exactly.
I getcha. I getcha.
And from an engineering point of view, we knew it was different. What was really exciting about Atari and Bally and the guys from Taito in Japan and Namco is they started the video games business, and they really introduced. Mm-hmm. And I talk about this all the time. They introduced the consumer to graphics on the computer and storytelling on the computer. Mm-hmm. And until you started to see games like Breakout and Missile Command and all the wonderful old games, starting with Space Invaders, which really kicked it off, the general world, the population, had no clue as to what these things could do. And the guys at Atari were just, and all of the guys, they had no teachers.
Mm-hmm. And they had to learn all on the fly.
They had to learn it all on the fly. They had to create it all on the fly. They were writing with limited memory in assembler language, which meant that, first they had to write the language in order to write the game. And they were working hardware and software guys as a team, because the software couldn't do everything that the game designers wanted it to do. So the hardware guys for every game had to invent or build a new hardware set.
Okay.
So, when I think back to what these guys did, both in consumer and coin-op, they were just brilliant.
Yeah. Are you still friends with any of the people who worked in who designed the games from back then?
Yeah, casually. Those people who are left. Yeah. I mean, we don't socialize. Occasionally we talk. I'll see a name creep up on Facebook or whatever.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I just did the guy who did the Superman pinball machines, the Atari pinball machines. I just saw his name crept up. And we just had a 10 or 12 minute, hello, how are you, mission.
That's cool, though. So working at Atari back then, so you handled mostly the distribution of those machines, or did you have any more hands-on with the making of them, or was the distribution?
It was strictly the sales and marketing and distribution and for half the country. So I handled half the country, guy by the name of Don Osborne handled the other half of the country. He was on the West Coast.
Okay.
We had gotten together. So my history is we had gotten together and we had determined that we would like to do new and different things at Atari. And we had taken the approach that Atari will always be good enough to get its fair share of the coin-operated business.
Mm-hmm.
But if we really want to grow the business, we really have to go out to the world. We have to speak to the Coca-Colas of this world and other people of this world, the McDonald's of this world, if you would, and tell them all the kind of things we could do from a technical point of view.
Yeah.
And a creative point of view. And we should take a different approach. So I wrote a business plan, but it was, you know, a collaboration between myself, Frank Ballou, Don Osborne, you know, the sales and marketing guys there, about exactly that. This is what we want to do. You know, we want to grow the business by becoming very, very proactive in other fields. And Atari was owned by Warner Communications at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the Warner guys bought into that. And they said, yeah, it's a great idea. Go for it. And they asked me, who would you like to be? Would you like to be that person? And I said, yes.
That you would be the liaison between Atari and these prospective.
Yeah, I would stop selling per se.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just call on whomever I wanted to call on and just be an evangelist. And that brought me into the consumer business because now we can combine. I crossed over and was probably one of the few people who really crossed over. And I worked with the consumer guys and the coin-operated guys to see if we could create different stories. So that's what I did. They moved me to the West Coast. And I was there for about 8 or 9 months, and I was approached by D. Gottlieb & Company. And D. Gottlieb was, at that point, the best pinball manufacturer in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But they were losing market share in pinball because they hadn't kept up to solid state. And the pinball was losing share to video. So they were owned by Columbia Pictures. And Columbia Pictures hired me to be the VP and general manager of the video games division.
So I remember seeing on online that you said you set up a department for Columbia Pictures. I didn't know Gottlieb was part of Columbia Pictures. And if I remember correctly, Columbia then got bought by Sony. So pretty much all,
no,
right?
Columbia, they actually got bought by Coca-Cola.
Columbia got bought by Coca-Cola?
Coca-Cola, and then Coke sold them to Sony or sold.
Oh, okay. That's so, I had no idea Coke got into them. That's fascinating. I had no idea.
Yeah. So I went to work for them, and I guess, you know, our big coin operated hit was Q-Bert.
Mm-hmm. Warren Davis designed that, correct?
Yeah.
If I remember correctly. Yeah.
Warren, Jeff Lee. Mm-hmm.
What, and so in your position with Atari and then moving on to Gottlieb, so did you handle the direct like marketing, like how you would try to advertise the specific arcade machines?
In those days, it was really, you know, you put the game out for test. You worked with, we had 50 distributors, 60 distributors across the United States. You called on the distributors, you demanded, tried to demand that they take 2 samples of everything mm-hmm. you built or... And they'd put them out for test and they'd give you reorders. By the time they put them out for test, we really knew at Atari and also at Gottlieb whether the game was good or bad.
Yeah.
And knew what to expect from it because we had pre-tested everything. So the marketing in CoinOp was really very simple. Just put the thing out for test, watch how much money it collects. Vis-a-vis everything else that you're testing it against, determines whether you have a hit or not.
What were some of the big test markets back then? I know casually, I've never really looked too far into the arcade industry, but like I know over in Seattle and like kind of like Oregon, Portland area, that was a fairly big like test market. What are some other big test markets that you would send them to?
Well, you know, certainly at Atari, everything was done pretty much locally.
Okay.
So we had 5 or 6 favored test locations. when I worked for Gottlieb, there were five or six arcades, a couple bars and taverns that we worked with to put the equipment out and get the tests. So get our initial tests, you know, A, to debug it, mm-hmm. and B, to determine how much money there was in the cash box. So it was really pretty much cut and dry. And the real trick, I guess, was not to lie to yourself.
If the
cash box was half full, you couldn't lie to yourself and say it's three quarters full and I'm going to build 300 games.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be able to, as a matter of fact, one of the big problems I had when I started Gottlieb and we hired 80 people, Warren Davis, Jeff Lee, those kind of guys, was when they finished their product and it was out for test, they were forbidden to bring their friends to the location and put money in the machines.
That makes, because otherwise they could fluff up the numbers, sure. and make it.
Yeah. And then I get a bad number and I go to build the thing and I get stuck with them.
Do you have any specific games without naming the developers? I don't want you to throw anyone. I guess if you name the game, people could look up the developers. I was going to say, did you have any games specifically that happened to you that you'd be comfortable saying, or I can move on to another question if you prefer?
No, because I was pretty diligent about that, you know.
Okay.
And I really made it a point. You guys can go. I want you to go there. I want you to watch. I want you to watch the players. I want you to get the feedback, any feedback you can get. But do not put any money into that cash box.
That makes sense.
And, now this, and if you do, tell me how much so I can deduct it.
From the totals. That's
from the actual earnings.
This might be like a bizarrely specific question, but what would dictate, like, how would you scout a location to determine it was good for testing for as a test market? Because I understand, like you said, the test market was your local area, but how would you determine, like, oh, this is a good place that that will be a good gauge of if a game is good or not?
Well, one of my test locations, you know, I had a couple of advantages. One of my test locations was a place called Mother's. Mm-hmm. Which was an arcade, you know, one of the original arcades. They had basically one of everything. So I could put my new product in there and I could read it against everything else.
Oh, I see. See if
so,
that stands out.
You know,
out.
If it collected third best or fifth best, you know, I could watch the amount of money that went in. And that coupled with what we had to do to debug it and whatever question and answers we got from it determined whether it was a good game. So there are three or four arcades like Mother's, and Mother's just happens to come to my mind because it's such a unique name.
Yeah, yeah. You don't really think of an arcade just name. Let's go to Mother's. Yeah. What? That's kind of funny.
We were able to test them very, very well. And I'm really proud of this. You know, first of all, you know, in my experiences, I was hired by Gottlieb/Columbia Pictures. So I had to go and be interviewed in New York by Columbia Pictures. And they gave me a budget. You know, they hired me. And then they said, but before we fund you, you have to write a business plan. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, what? I mean, you already hired me. You already moved my family.
what an awful thing to do. Like, oh, yeah, you do all that work only to then have another test, another hoop to jump through.
Yeah. So I wrote a business plan, and the business plan was predicated, and I borrowed from Atari, you know, only my experiences at Atari.
Borrow what you know.
And I wrote a plan that was based on, we always need product of choice. And if I'm going to be successful, I've got to develop 3, 4, 5 games at a time so I can choose the best one. So if you're going to fund me, you have to fund me X amount of dollars so I can hire Y people mm-hmm. and work on X amount of product. And maybe 1 in 4 will be a Qubit or whatever the number is.
Yeah.
But the first one, you know, if I only do one, I'm going to fail.
Because yeah, unless you hit that one lucky shot, you know, it's yeah, that makes exactly. sense. That's a smart way to go into
it. And they boiled into it, and they said no problem. They come from the you know movie business. They understood creativity and hit to failure. And I said, fine, you've got the budget. And that allowed me to go out and hire the first engineer who went out and hired 60 engineers or whatever the number was. But, you know.
Okay.
And that's how we built it, and that's what we did. And in its third year, when we had Qbert followed by Mach 3, which was the second Laserdisc game to come to the market, and Dragon's Lair beat us by a week, so they became by history
the first. Everyone, yeah.
But we worked on it, unbeknownst to each other, we were working on it simultaneously. And I know that we sold more. Dragon's Lair gets all the credit, but Gottlieb actually sold more Missile Commands than Dragon's Lair.
Or do you mean Mach 3s?
Mach 3, yeah.
That's actually really interesting. Because you're right. Like, everyone thinks of Dragon's Lair when it comes to the first laser. I mean, on a technical level, it is. But like you said, they only beat you by a week. That's fascinating. Now, what are some of your favorite games that you, besides Qbert and Mach 3, are there any other games that you put out and got while you were at Gottlieb that you were particularly proud of, or that you thought or you think deserves more love that not a lot of people talk about?
Well, there was a game called Reactor. The first game that we actually put out. And we knew from test that it wasn't going to be great, but it was good enough that we could release 1,000 games.
Mm-hmm.
So that was our first game. And we liked that very, very much. I think there are a couple of failures in there that I really liked. We did a game called Guardian, which was a flight kind of a warring kind of a game, where the guy was, whose job was, he was superhero, a Superman. It failed. And I really liked it. So,
I mean, it's not necessarily because it's one of those things where, especially with a creative medium, there's a game that may fail at the time, but years later, people will go back and be like, that was a lot better than it deserved credit for.
Oh, yeah. Just
stuff like that happens. So Guardian, I'm going to have to look out for that because, you know, like I was
you'll never find it because we never built it.
Oh, you never built it.
I mean,
okay, but, so it just ended up.
But from
up,
an emotional point of view, I really liked it. I mean,
I understand. So you put it in the test market. It didn't do well, and then it never went into full production. Oh,
and then we have a whole bunch of things that you worked on that, you know, you really think are great. When you were talking about the licensing and the music, we licensed the Three Stooges.
Okay.
And it bombed. I mean, it never made it past test. It was 3/4 of the way done when I had left the company, but I was, you know, I licensed it. We just never got it right. And the guys who were working on it, we just never got it right. And that, you know, that bothered me. We did a game called Kroll, which was a Columbia Pictures movie.
Mm.
I went to Pinehurst which was a lot of fun in England to the studios. We built a better game than they did movie. Nobody ever went to see the movie.
And this was called Crawl?
Crawl, yeah.
And did this one get released, or was it just a test market thing again?
No, we actually built Crawl.
Okay.
A couple hundred of them, whatever.
That's still really cool, though. From there, did you move on? I know you also eventually made your way over to Jolico. Was there any stops in between Gottlieb and Jolico?
What really happened to me is I had left them to go to work for a company with a parts company, a manufacturer. And I was there for about 3 or 4 months, and it didn't work as president of the company. It didn't work for me, and it didn't work for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started with a guy who I knew in the coin operated businesses, probably, you know, in the old coin operated days, his name was Magic, a guy by the name of Joe Robbins. Mm-hmm. We started a company called Kit Corp, and we went to Japan and we started to buy printed circuit boards. And we, instead of replacing your whole game, we just sold the printed circuit board with a little artwork. And if we needed a control panel, and you could take your old cabinet.
And just swap out the board, replace the artwork.
Swap out the board. And we had a heck of a little business going for a couple of years, 2 or 3 years. And all of a sudden the people that we were buying from, Sega, Namco, Taito, they all wanted to come into the United States.
Okay.
So we were offered, we were both offered jobs if we wanted to take them, with one of the Japanese companies. We had our choices. And we both collectively elected not to do that. Although Joe started to work for a company by the name of Sun, we stopped doing that. And I started my own little company, HR Management, from Kiko. And I designed a couple of redemption games, video redemption games for the arcades, you know, where you put your money and win tickets.
Okay, okay.
So I did that. And while I was doing that, you know, through the HR management stuff, I was contacted by Konami.
Now, sorry, real quick, what year would this be approximately? Because I'm trying to see if this is pre-NES in the US or like...
It was just as NES was starting.
It was just as NES was starting. So 85, 84?
Konami was in the development business,
mm-hmm.
Starting again like everybody else. They started in the consumer business. They were one of four or five companies, Konami, Jalico, Taito, Namco, and Sun, who were the original third-party developers for Nintendo in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, the way it worked, I don't know whether you're familiar with the way it worked. If you were a developer, you developed the product, you took it to Nintendo. They tested it. They did all the work for it. They built it. They manufactured it.
Yep.
They shipped back a box.
I know they had very strict licensing practices in the US specifically. You can only publish so many games per year, and that's why Konami ended up creating Ultra Games that way they can kind of skirt
around
that.
You were allowed 5 games a year.
Mm-hmm.
So a friend of mine who also grew up in the coin operator business was the president of Konami. They were going to come into the United States. So he hired me as a consultant to help him put together the first product. So I actually helped him, do Gradius and Track and Field, which were their two first products. I think it was
you helped bring them over to the US?
Yeah. And set up, I set up their distribution, not their distribution system, but yeah, their sales network. We worked through reps. So I hired the original reps and I took care of the box design, that kind of stuff for Konami. And then I did that for Taito.
What by box design, do you mean like you actually would design like art, you would design the boxes or did you?
Yeah, I went to a design. I went to a designer and contracted them out,
mm-hmm.
And got it box ready in the United States.
So you orchestrated the whole, I gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then, they went on and I hired their first reps. So I did that so that was pretty lucky for me because I did that for them and I did it for Taito. As a matter of fact, it's really funny because about a week ago, I got a phone call from some students over in Europe and they were doing some retro stuff and there was a game called Arkanoid, which was Taito's first
mm-hmm.
game, and how they found out that I was involved with it, I have no idea because I had I spent about a month working for them, and Arkanoid needed a special controller, and so I got I didn't design the controller, but I contracted the designer of the potentiometer.
Okay.
For them, and we had an argument we had a huge argument with Taito Japan because they didn't want to use a special controller, which added to the cost of the box.
Mm-hmm.
We said, no, if you're going to do it. And they let us do it. So we built Arkanoid. And how these guys found out that I was involved in it just blew me away. Because I would never remember that.
That's so interesting because one of the things I looked up was on the Moby Games website. I was trying to see what credits you were listed under. And this is why I wish they had more credits and stuff in like video games, because like you would nowadays, you would be on the credits for orchestrating this whole thing. But on Moby Games, you only have stuff from when you were with Jolly Co, which I find interesting that this wasn't included. So from what I'm understanding, you helped set up the network for Taito and for Konami to get their games out to the US. Like, you would hire all the reps for them to call the different distributors.
Yeah, exactly. So, but you know, so yeah, the two presidents, both at Konami, Ben Harrell, and Paul Moriarty at Taito, who I'd known from coin operated days. You know, I was in between games at HAR. They said, "Would you like to?" And I said, "Sure, you know, why not?" And yeah, I had a wife and four kids to feed. So I did that. And then Jalico came along, and I'd also known Jalico from my trips to Japan when we had Kit Corp. And Mr. Kanazawa offered me a job. I said, "No, I'll do it as a consultant again." He said, No. I would really like you to come to work for me. And we'll form Jalico USA, and I'll give you enough budget that you take my games that I give you, the Japanese games that I give you, but I'll allow you to go out and source and develop some of your own games.
The entire month of April this year is sponsored by Geek Guild. Geek Guild is your go-to online store for all of your guilty pleasure geeky needs. They have everything from costumes to home decor and even modern and retro video games. In fact, if you're listening to this episode, you will know that Howie Rubin worked at Jolico, who made Bases Loaded, and you can actually buy a copy of Bases Loaded for the NES from Geek Guild. So go to geekguild.com and check out everything they have to offer. Before we go into this, I'm still like thinking on something you just said a little bit ago. So were you the one that put in the special Arkanoid controller for the NES? I know that's nothing to do with what we're talking about right now, but so you contracted out the special controller to make it more playable than like on the normal NES pad.
Right.
That's so cool. Sorry, that blew my mind.
And, yeah,
that's fascinating.
And again, I'm not an engineer. I just hired the engineers to do it.
But you saw the need for it and went out and hired.
I saw the need for it. I convinced Paul Moriarty, who is the president of the company, to argue the case with Taito, you know, Japan.
Yeah, yeah.
And he argued it very successfully.
That's so fascinating. I'm sorry to cut you off. We were talking about Jolico. It just stuck with me for a second. So I had to ask that question before we got too far away from it. So you're talking about how Jolico hired you, and they gave you pretty much free rein to not only take the games from Japan, but also for you to go out and seek out games to publish. Okay.
So our first game in the 8-bit that we introduced was Bases Loaded.
Very popular series.
And Bases Loaded became a smash hit.
I know
we sold more product. Atari had RBI or whatever they called it. The name
RBI
of the game.
Baseball was theirs, yeah.
Yeah. And because I was friendly with them, we had an honest running bet who would sell more, and I won.
Now, since you were still friendly with Atari, was there any like... how did you know about all the stuff they were doing with Tengen with the unlicensed publishing that they were doing at the time? I know that's kind of like a little bit tangential to it, but like, cause you know, Tengen was a licensed publisher for a while on the NES, and then they got tired of Nintendo's restrictive policies and kind of went rogue.
I don't know I don't know much about that. I really don't know much about them. I knew, you know, what they were doing at Tengen. I knew what everybody else, pretty much what, you know, all the people were doing. But, you know, Atari was really, Nintendo was, it became very, very tough to manage because they had what they called, they had chip shortage and they had allocation. So you had to go out and you had to work 4 or 5 months in advance to give them an order.
Oh, no.
And that was a bitch. I mean, so you've got Bases Loaded, you've got this, you've got that, you've got how many city connections. Can I rebuild? How many goals can I do? How many hoops? Can I rebuild? And 4 or 5 months away. And that's when people started to get into trouble because nobody knew.
I mean, that's a long time to.
Everybody was releasing games before they knew A, their games were absolutely finished, and B, what they were going to compete against.
That's I can only imagine. Like, that's so much time. That's insane.
And I will tell you my favorite my favorite story during those times. We licensed Maniac Mansion from Lucas.
Classic game, one of the most popular point and click adventures of all time.
Yeah. And there was one scene in it where you put the hamster in the microwave and you blew it up.
Yeah.
So I elected to put that in to the Nintendo game, knowing or believing wholeheartedly that when they QA'd it, they would see it and they would say, Howie, that's a no-no. You got to take it out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they never saw it. So we released, I think, 250 or 300,000 games. And all of that is based on letter of credit. So, you know, here's our game that you approve it. Here's our order. We open up a letter of credit. That letter of credit gets payable when the goods hit my deck, was the terms. I got a call from them while the goods were on the water. They said, we discovered the hamster. You can't sell the game. And this was the vice president of whatever his job was. I don't remember what his name was. And he said to me, you can't sell a game. I said, what do you mean I can't sell a game? He said, well, you blowing up the hamster. I said, I think you better talk to Mr. Arakawa and Mr. Lincoln, the president and the executive vice president of the company. He said, I don't have to talk to them. You can't sell the game. I said to him, let me call you right back. I called my lawyer and I had my lawyer read the terms of the letter of credit to make sure that I was right, that I don't own the goods unless I sign for the little lady. So I called him back about 10 minutes later. I said, so let me ask you a question. You've got 300,000 games on the water. They're going to land in Chicago. Where would you like me to ship them? Because we're never going to take ownership.
Yeah. Oh,
of games that we can't sell.
Yeah.
And, you know, he yelled and he screamed and he cursed and he called me all sorts of names. And I got a call from the president of the company. He said, so I'll tell you what, Howie, for the first 300,000 of the games, you can blow up the hamster. But if you reorder it,
you have to take it out.
You have to take it out. And we used that as a marketing thing that said, good only for the first releases.
That's fantastic. So then, since you used it to market it, you almost had to keep it in. Did you ever?
No, we had to take it. We had to take it.
Okay, so did you end up ordering another batch and take it out for that other batch?
A small batch, but not very many.
That's great. So there are versions of Maniac Mansion out there that don't have the hamster blowing up.
Yeah.
The collector's market right now is insane. I wonder if anyone knows that. I wonder if people have collected the two different. I'm sure there has to have been someone. If they know it. That's blowing my mind right now.
That was one of my all time favorites.
That's a great story though. That's so good. Mm. The fact that's so smart too. Oh, that's good. So then. With what other, so you had Bases Loaded, Jaleco, you had Maniac Mansion. You ended up, I mean, Jaleco published a whole bunch. I do see that you were.
We had Hoops in Your Face. We had
Indiana Jones. That was Super Nintendo, I think, but it's still.
No,
was it NES?
Started off and say NES.
Yes, okay.
I had started to leave. I left Jaleco as 16-bit. Well, no. I did the first 16-bit games. I did Bases Loaded, which we licensed Ryan Sandberg. And, you know, the 16-bit games were not the first ones because everybody was rushed. basis loaded for 16-bit was not as good as basis loaded 8-bit.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that. And if you trace the original 16-bit games, especially those that were versions of, you will find none of them were as good as the 8-bit.
What was the reasons for that? Like, was it just everybody, the chip shortages again?
No, everybody was rushed. Everybody wanted to come to market with the 16-bit to be the first guys out there.
Yeah, that's...
And so you took what you had on the shelf and you converted it as quickly as you possibly could.
How much was that pressure from the Japanese parent company, or was it like, where was that pressure coming from to rush the games? Or just like
Japanese
internal?
In our case, the Japanese parent company is a public company.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So they had the same public pressures for their stocks as we had. And I think I was pretty well, my boss, the guy who owned the company, Mr. Kanazawa, you know, the discussions I had with him are, do you want me to be aggressive or non-aggressive?
Mm-hmm.
And he set the tone, and his tone to me was, I'm willing to take risks, be aggressive in your releases. And that was, you know, that was his call.
Mm-hmm.
And that made my job much easier, or much less. There was no, I didn't have the pressure of deciding whether I'm going to be cautious or conservative.
You just went with what the boss said. And so then whether it goes well.
Yeah, I mean, I called the number, but he dictated the posture.
I getcha.
And, you know, he was great. He was a fantastic human being. Great man to work for.
One of the other games that Jaleco published that was super popular, Shatterhand.
I didn't have anything to do with Shatterhand.
You didn't have anything to do with Shatterhand? Okay. I wasn't sure when that exactly came out. I was 91. 91 is when that came out.
Yeah.
Okay. So
Shatterhand, I think, was 16-bit only. It wasn't 8-bit.
No, there's an NES version for it.
Okay.
Oh, that's interesting. That's
you could be right. I don't remember.
So now I'm very... So that's very weird. I'm going to have to look into this for... I see why... Yeah, that makes more sense now. So Shatterhand, even though it says it was published by Jaleco USA, it when you click on it, it actually says it's published by Nintendo and developed by Natsume. So I have no idea. So I'm very confused with that.
No.
But that makes a lot more sense now. but okay. When... Working at Jaleco, you were the president of the American branch,
right?
Correct? What were your overall were your responsibilities as president? Like, because that's obviously very different from being a distribution, from being the sales and marketing, and like working in coin op and being the head.
I set up the company.
You set up the company?
I mean, you know, anything that happened in the USA,
yeah,
you know, came through me and or the staff that we hired. So, you know,
you mentioned before there were games that you were given free license to not only take the games from Japan, but also like go out and seek games out on your own. Was Bases Loaded one of the games that you sought out, or does that come from Japan?
No, that came from Japan. That was a huge hit. That was Jaleco's huge hit in Japan.
Okay. What were some games that you sought out? Like, what were some games that you found that you ended up publishing?
We storyboarded In Your Face,
mm-hmm.
which was the basketball game. I don't know whether you're familiar with it.
Mm-hmm. I actually am not, but...
Okay. We licensed Ninja Warriors. Was a game we licensed. Maniac Mansion, obviously. Young Indy.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, and a bunch of games. My memory is shot. I have to look them up. But you know, I traveled Europe, mainly England. We had a guy in England who was Jaleco Europe,
okay.
Norman Leffley, and I traveled with Norman, and we called on all the brilliant young developers in England, and all these guys were, again, self-taught, home-taught, developed everything on their old Commodore computers,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, we traveled, we looked, and I don't know, we licensed 5-6 games, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. Licensed the game from Konami Juno 1st. Oh, no, that was at that I did when I was at Gottlieb.
Okay.
But, you know, licensed, bought, storyboarded some.
Okay. So from Jolly Code, how long did you end up working with Jolly Co? How long did you stay with the company?
I was with Jolly Co for 3 years.
Okay. Man, it's so interesting to hear all these stories, and it seems like you were only there for just like 2 to 3 years, and
I was there for 3 years or whatever the number was. I don't know. I'd have to really look at a calendar. And then I left again, and I went back to HAR, and I designed my own, a couple of redemption games. My wife, oddly enough, stayed there. My Jolly Co USA was formed in my house.
Oh.
So the president, Mr. Kanazawa, and Mr. Saigusa came to the United States, and we sat at my kitchen table.
That's so cool.
And Mr. Kanazawa met my wife. She fed him. She done the things for him. And she was a school teacher. And, you know, my kids had grown at that time. They were old enough that she was considering going back to teaching or doing whatever she wanted to do. And mm-hmm. he just looked at her and he said, "Why don't you come to work for us at Jolly Co? Because you know how to handle the Japanese people."
That's really cool.
"And you'll come to work." And so I quit. I left, and she stayed there. And then I went back about a year later, a year and a half later, because they had problems. They had collection problems, and they had a couple of other problems that had to be straightened out. And so I went back for a year. And then that's when they were in the 16-bit business.
Okay.
But only for a year. I mean, it was known just for short term. Now, so that was my story with them. And then somewhere along the lines, I guess my background is through my work with Lucas, I'm became reasonably friendly or close with a guy by the name of Doug Glenn. And Doug was head of Lucas Studios. Actually, he was the second head. There was one guy before him. But Doug went on to form Mattel Media.
Okay.
And he came to me and he said, I got a very, very special kind of a job. And we can work outside of Mattel. I'd like you and a guy by the name of Andy Rifkin, who is one of the smartest toy designers I've ever met in my life. He said, "The three of us can start Mattel Media. You'll take care of part of it. He'll take care of part of it." And we were supposed to be licensed, or the rules were that we could design. Mattel was looking for new products to build. And mm-hmm. if I did video games, then they could build a toy line over them. And we were also supposed to use some of their products.
Oh, okay.
Well, the way it worked out, that it was, they never approved anything that we wanted to design as a video game. And we had to do their products.
Mm-hmm.
And they never designed those. So I spent a year and a half. I hated Mattel and Barbie. They hated me. We left. But one of the, I guess, claim to fame is, the three of us had to approve everything. So I approved, and it was really an Andy Rifkin thing that he created Barbie Fashion Designer, which was a huge, huge.
There's still people that talk about it too. I was listening to a different podcast a little while ago, and it was just talking about like applications, yep. and stuff that was marketed towards girls. And that was the theme of the episode. And they mentioned Barbie Fashion Designer and how popular it was and how much they liked the game. So that's interesting. You kind of set the wheels in motion for that, but Mattel was just a hellhole to work for.
Yeah. Because, you know, I was not from that culture.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Barbie couldn't lose. Barbie couldn't do this. Barbie couldn't do that. We designed things that never got built, that tested in the coin-operated world, other than the fact that part of the tests, you know, was to repair things and they broke down. But from a Coinbox point of view, they were incredible. We did a thing called Mattel-owned Frisbees.
Mm-hmm.
So we designed something we called Frisbee Dog.
Okay.
And you know how you go to an arcade and you play Hoops, the basketball game?
Yeah.
We put a dog on a moving rod that went up and down with its mouth open, and you threw the Frisbee, and there was a coil, and if you got it in his mouth, the coils
would
snap
bite down.
Closed, you caught the Frisbee. You win points, you win tickets, depending on how many you could catch, and that's you get your doll.
That's a great idea. They didn't approve
it. They never
it.
Built it. We did a Hot Wheels game that was incredible. The Hot Wheels guys didn't like it. So again, you know, when you're dealing with licenses, you know, they didn't like the color. They didn't like this. Well, all we knew is there were a ton of quarters in the machine. The players liked it. The arcades that we tested it at.
Yeah.
Liked it. They never built it. We took the Barbies. We took a kiddie ride.
Mm-hmm.
And they had the Barbie, I don't know, the motorized car, little kiddie ride car, runs on a battery.
Mm-hmm.
We put that car on the kiddie ride.
Okay.
Put a camera there so that the little girl could take her picture while driving the Barbie car.
Yeah.
We also built in a way that you could sell from the machine. You could not only sell that, but other Hot Wheel cars. They never built it.
They never went for it. That's
and
so
after they approved it, after we worked on it, after we, you know, designed the prototypes, and all we really had to do was tighten up and finish up. And so it was awful. So
that's so that's even worse. It'd be different if, I mean, it still would suck, but like if they approved it, if they didn't approve anything you did, that would be demoralizing. But at least it's not like, I don't know, it feels like if I was in your shoes and I would get the approval, go through all that work only to have them not do anything with it. That's just like, why am I doing any of this?
Right. And, you know, I guess what they didn't understand when we put these out for tests, we knew that we still had to do engineering work to make them work, you know, to be solid pieces of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the problems that they thought when we put it out for test, they weren't going to break.
Like, that you can put it out for test that it wouldn't break, sorry?
Yeah, they assumed that everything was finished product.
The two different cultures. They just...
Yeah.
Did they ever like ask about, like, I feel like if they hired if I was in their shoes, I would trust the people I hired until like there's a reason not to. But like it looks like they never even gave you a chance to pass or fail anything. They just didn't do anything. They sat on everything.
Yeah. And it got to a point where they didn't like me and I didn't like them. So I think they were very well relieved that I said it first. That I said I quit.
I don't blame you. From now, was that your last job in the game industry? Or because I know you worked about, from what I was able to find online, you worked about 35 years in the game industry, and then you ended up moving on to something, to Gems Core, or was there something?
No. The other thing I did is, I developed it again for myself, and I licensed it to Williams. I did one slot machine, and under contract to them, I designed a couple of redemption games where I, you know, we put together the idea and we brought them finished product to manufacture.
Mm-hmm.
So that was that. And then I met, I guess in my career, at Atari, one of the things with the special works that we were doing is we walked into McDonald's and we designed an electronics store back in 1979 for McDonald's.
Really?
Where we took a kid's counter where your daughter, I'm not sure, you know, a 3, 4-year, 5-year-old kid could walk up, push a button, order the Big Mac, and get a token back that was redeemable for a prize.
Oh.
Right at the counter. We built a portable game for their birthday parties, an electronic kind of pin a tail on the donkey. We took their outside displays and you know, that was a huge part of their business, pick up a, and we built a wall, a digitized wall. In those days, it was all LEDs.
Okay.
Where as you were waiting for your order, you could see your Mac, your fries, your Coke being built, and it would upsell.
That's really
so
cool.
We designed all of those things. And, you know, it was the Atari engineers that did the design work. I brought McDonald's in. That was my job, you know, based on what I had said to them. So I brought them in. So that got me really interested in the consumer world and, you know, how do you use point of sale and point of this, that, and the other thing.
Mm-hmm.
When I left all these guys, I wanted to do, mobile was starting. It was more flip phones at the time, moving into smart. I started to storyboard a game that Sears or JCPenney's or whomever could use so that they could drive product. So people would play their game, and drive product and that kind of thing. And I met Scava. I was introduced to Scava and they were in the games business. And we started out by thinking about how we could design a video game for retail that moved people from location to location in retail.
Okay.
And we wound up coming up with the smartphone was really happening. And we wound up with, we designed a product called My Mall, where we aggregated 300 stores. And we started to build that, and it was way ahead of its time. We really couldn't complete the sale. We couldn't keep records of the sale, but we put it out and we were learning. And we called on Macy's, the president of Macy's online. And, you know, he gave us about a 2-hour session on a Friday afternoon. And we just talked about futures, and we had determined and he had determined that Scava, because of its porting technologies for games, because when you're in a flip phone business, you had to port to 200 different devices.
Yeah.
One game. I mean, it was a nightmare. So they had porting technology and he needed it. So we actually contracted with them to do special things, develop some special features for them, and then porting some of their stuff to all the phones. And from there, Scava started, and I spent 8 or 9 years working with them. I was just as a consultant, but you know, I landed their first three. I got them the appointment with them and Sears and the Gap, which were their first three locations, and Staples, and they grew that into a business that 3 or 4 years ago, whatever it was, they sold to Infosys.
Okay.
And that was, you know, that was the end of it. And I'm 80 years old, so I kind of haven't done anything, although in the last year and a half, I'm working with an Indian company to, again, a very, very talented Indian group, to, again, do mobile applications for e-commerce. And I really find it incredibly interesting because there's a real dilemma out there. And the dilemma is that in the shopper's journey today, mm-hmm. it's mobile first.
Mm-hmm.
And mobile apps outperform mobile web pages.
Yes.
So if you want to be successful, you need a mobile app. Well, the average user has maybe 100 apps on their deck. 10 of them would be in the shopping category. Walmart is going to take one. Amazon is going to take another. eBay is going to take a third. So these companies are having a tremendous difficulty in building up an install base, number one, and worse than that, retaining it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the drop-off rate is like astronomical. And we think that we can build experiences. Now, this company is not only in the e-commerce business over there, but they've won awards in the casual gaming business, the best Google games. They did SpongeBob Cook-Off, Cooking Truck. And, they're really creative. So not only do they understand e-commerce and have built e-commerce microservices, they also have the creative. And we're trying to use that creative to tell people that, look, your user, you know, it all starts with the user experience. And everybody wants to build a mobile app because they want to capture the data and then they want to use artificial intelligence to segment their messages so that they're talking directly to you with the equipment you need. but it all starts with a mailing list. And the mailing list starts with the user experience.
Mm-hmm.
So we can build you, because of our creativity, we can build you user experience.
I gotcha.
And so that's what I fool around with these days.
So that's what you...
Whether it'll happen or not, I don't know. But I like
but you like doing it. That's the most important thing. You know, like it's a new challenge for you to face, for you to like to learn about and like to try to solve this problem. That's interesting.
I'm 80 years old and I feel as if, you know, I spend 3 or 4 hours a day reading, doing these things. It keeps me busy. It's my golf game.
I mean, I think that's important though. I think like, especially like my dad's retired and he stays busy. Like he still works part time. Like it's a different thing, but it's important just to keep yourself. I think it makes you happy. Like that's just staying productive, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm about ready to wrap this up. I wanted to ask you, is there anything, I have two questions to close out on here. One, is there anything that you'd like to promote? You were talking about your work with that company that I feel so bad. I'm just blanking on the name. The company that just was sold to Infosys, and now you're working with...
Got it. So those are the guys who have done Swell.
Okay. For listeners, Swell is a new social media app that I was invited to do an AMA on, and that's actually how I met Howie, which was really cool. Is that the same company that you're working with for this?
No.
It's a different company that you're working with right now. Okay. But is there anything you'd like to promote? Anything that you're working on currently that you'd like the listeners to know about?
I'm not actively developing product yet. We're developing things that could be developed into product.
Okay.
So, you know, and our problem is, you know, we want to go to Procter & Gamble's and tell them how to build up a better mobile app.
Okay.
And our real problem is how the hell you get into Procter & Gamble's.
it's a huge company. It's
easier to create the story than the product.
Mm-hmm.
But I will tell you, you know, as part of the Swell thing, I did speak to, I told you I spoke to the open world designer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I told him about the conversation that was going on about and my point of view, the nightmares of dealing with licensed product.
Yeah.
And he said, when they develop a pinball, it's 40 remakes of the glass.
Of the glass?
Yeah. Just to get the picture right. The color, you know, it's not Superman's cape. It's not Marvel Comics, whatever. And he said, it's, you know, it's just a nightmare.
No wonder. There's a stigma in the gaming community that licensed games generally aren't very good. And it's no surprise then as to why then, because like you're saying, you have to jump through so many hoops when you're dealing with licensed properties. Back in like the 80s and 90s, some licensed games were actually pretty decent, but those were still few and far between. It's even fewer and farther between now, where it's just, they're so hard. So I'm not surprised to hear that if they have to go through 40 different versions of glass just to make a pinball machine, let alone what everything, it's insane.
Yeah. I mean, the changes that they throw at you and, you know, it's just a nightmare. And, you know, I think the biggest fiasco of all, you know, going back to the Atari days was E.T.
Yeah. You mentioned that on our Swell conversation. Yeah.
They built more ETs, or almost as many ETs, as they had consoles out there. They almost thought it was going to be a one-on-one sale.
They built a terrible attach rate.
The game was awful, and they thought just the strength of the name ET would sell through. Well, the player, you know, took a look at the game, played it once, and said, "This is awful."
Mm-hmm.
And that was the downfall of Atari. They could never get rid of the massive use.
Did you ever hear Howard Scott Warshaw's story about the game at all? The guy who developed it?
No.
He talks about how he actually had a book that just came out recently. He recently, within the last year or so, he wrote a book. I haven't read it yet, but I've read and listened to interviews with him where it's like, he knew he was only given 5 weeks to design the game, but he knew that he only had 5 weeks and he still took the job on. So it was this really weird mix of just giving the developers absolutely no time to make anything, but at the same time he kind of was like, I can handle this, and he took it. It was a very it's an interesting story to look into, to say the least. But I can, yeah, that the idea of selling a one-to-one attach rate, one like consoles to cartridges, is just, that is a very,
well, they almost, I mean, I don't know what the right number is, but it was almost like that. I mean, it was, you know, maybe it was 75%, whatever it was. It was ridiculous. And you know, they built a shitty product.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong at all. Oh my goodness. Howie, this was a pleasure to talk to you. I had a lot of fun hearing your story, like working your way up through just the fact that you got started in the coin op business by just a friend that started up a small little independent business, and it just, you took off from there, and now you've sold stuff to Macy's and stuff. That's really, that's awesome. So to wrap this all up, I have one final question for you and listeners, as you all know what's coming. It's questions from Courtney. Courtney is my wife, and she is famously not into video games or a lot of the stuff that I'm into. It's a very opposites attract kind of couple here. But and her random question, she has no idea anything that you've ever done. It's she goes in blind. She just asks a random question. And her question is, if you could have an animal sidekick, what would it be?
I'd have to say a dog.
A dog, fair enough.
That's the easy one, and I happen to own one. We've always had a dog, so.
That's a good point. I have my wife and I, we have a dog as well, so I don't know if that's what would I go with for an animal sidekick?
But we've also had cats, birds, rabbits, but I would go with a dog.
Well, dog, yeah, more loyal. I could understand that. All right, so.
Tell your wife that my wife of 55 years, she was expelled from Michigan State because she had a fox in her dormitory room.
What? Oh, but
along with a monkey.
Wait, what? The fox was burying the lead there. She had a monkey as well.
A monkey and a fox. So I don't know what her favorite animal would be.
That is fantastic. We've always wanted a pet fox, but we've heard they're like a combination of a dog and a cat at the same time, like this bizarre hybrid of an animal. Fox and a monkey. What an eclectic pair of friends that she had in her dorm. All right. That will do it for this episode. Howie, is there any social media that you like to plug? Is there any or anything like that?
I'm not a user of social media. I mean, I have a Facebook account. I have a LinkedIn account. I don't use them. I watch my grandkids on Instagram or TikTok or whatever.
Fair enough. As for me, as usual, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillLoadingPod on all of them. Also on Swell at StillLoadingPod over on Swell. Any of you are interested in the Swell app, you can support the show in a number of ways. You can give it a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you use. That helps more people find the show. If you want to support it monetarily, you can go to Patreon.com/StillLoadingPod. For $1 a month, you'll get the episodes a few days earlier, at a higher bitrate, as well as access to a patron exclusive Discord. You can also, or if you decide to go to the $5 level, you'll get all of that plus 2 bonus episodes a month, which actually, now I'm thinking about it, I have to record one between tonight and tomorrow for this Friday. So I need to make sure I get on that. 2 extra bonus episodes a month. Patreon.com/StillLoadingPod. But the most important shout out I have is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of kids receiving inpatient care in hospitals. So if you want to go support them, go to bitbybitfoundation.org and consider donating. And that will do it for this episode of Still Loading. Howie, once again, thank you so much for joining me.
Let me make a comment about that, about your last remarks.
Yeah, yeah.
When we were at Atari, we started to evangelize games, you know, and of course everybody says the violence of games, this, that, and the other thing. I think the skill set that you learn from playing a game watch, recall, recall, watch is probably one of the most important skill sets that people need today. To be able to see something on that screen, to be able to take in all that information, and to be able to use that information and continually lose that information. And I think the video games have paved the way for that, and they've been a tremendous learning curve for what every kid needs today in order to survive.
I never would have really thought about it that way, but I always like to evangelize video games because I love them, but like I think that's a really interesting viewpoint, and I agree with it. But I agree. I wish I had something more to expand upon with that, but I agree with you. It gives people a safe space to make decisions and fail and be able to make decisions on the fly and see their decisions react and come to fruition in real time, in a very condensed microcosm of a world, of course. But it's one of my favorite aspects about it is just being able to.
Every surgeon needs how to control a server or how to use a controller.
Yep. And what the Bit by Bit Foundation does is that it's mainly for kids like who just have nothing to do in hospitals, and they actually donated. This was about a month or two ago, but they donated. Microsoft has those accessibility controllers for kids or for people who can't physically hold a standard controller. It's meant for people with different types of physical disabilities. Maybe they don't have maybe they can't use their hands, or maybe they can't use parts of it. So they donated two of those to a local hospital. So that way as kids come in, they can use it while they are there. So it's a really good charity. It was actually started up by some friends that I used to work with at an old job. Him and his college buddies started up the nonprofit, and they've been at it for about 2, 3, or maybe 4 years. It's been a minute. It's been a little bit since they started up. But yeah, so the Bit by Bit Foundation.
This is great. I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
No problem, Howie. And that's all I got for you. Thank you all for listening. I will see you all next time.